Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today I'm talking with Melvin A. Goodman, the author of Whistleblower at the CIA. Mel Goodman wasn't actually a secret agent man, but he spent almost 24 years at the CIA and State Department as a Russian expert. And today, he shares his powerful new book that's part memoir, part a narrative about his whistleblower experience, and a very interesting annotated account of the lies that the CIA has delivered over the years. I want to thank the people who make my program possible here with your subscriptions. People like Brian Wilcutz, Joe Clarici, Brian Mazzi, and Arlene Montemarano. They kick in $5 or $10 a month to support my work, and I'd like you to do the same. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, find the menu button, click on it, then click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and you can find a level of support that's comfortable for you and your budget. I appreciate your support, and I'm glad you're listening. Melvin A. Goodman returns to the Peter B. Collins podcast today. He served 24 years at the CIA and State Department, a Russia expert, and went on to teach at the National War College for 18 years. He remains the director of the National Security Project at the Center for International Policy. And he's got a timely and important new book out called Whistleblower at the CIA, an insider's account of the politics of intelligence. Mel Goodman, welcome back to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you, Peter. It's good to be with you again. It's been a while.
It has, and I've been waiting eagerly for your new book, and it is finally out. I want to note that my opening music there was selected very carefully from the Peter B. Collins tax-deductible music archives. It's Billy Strange's version of the theme to the TV show I Spy.
And I thought it had a James Bond quality to it.
Well, that was a hit show. During the Johnson administration, when you first joined the CIA, Bill Cosby was playing a globe-trotting spy.
And there I was, right out of graduate school.
So, Mel, I want to note that I've been talking to you now for 13 or 14 years. I first was introduced to you when you appeared in a Robert Greenwald film about the Iraq War called Uncovered. And I want to note recent interviews over the last couple of years on your book, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, and Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. And those books, as a former intelligence officer, you're required to submit for pre-approval by the CIA. And one of the reasons, you know, I've got an email chain, and I kept saying, hey, Mel, where's your whistleblower book? You teased my listeners about that years ago, and they kind of held it up for a while, didn't they, Mel?
They got that book in March of 2016, and I think I made two trips out to the Marble Palace to work out suggested changes, and that was February or March of this year. So it took them a year. The only good thing about that is that it's coming out at a much more controversial and timely period than if they would have read it in the 1 month that they had it. So being slow readers, I think maybe they did me a favor.
Now, the people who do pre-publication review, did they ever take Evelyn Wood's speed reading course like I did?
they take speed reading when they look at, say, Leon Panetta's memoirs. Leon, the former director, submitted his the night before the publisher was sending them out to the bookstores for distribution. Leon Panetta also used a ghostwriter from the Los Angeles Times, who I imagine did not have security clearances. So this is a classic case of the double standard, by the way, that I write about in the book. I spent a chapter on the double standard, and Leon Panetta's handling, or the handling he got from the CIA, is a very good example of that. And Robert Gates's last memoir, Duty, mm-hmm. I love the title, Duty, never even was submitted to the CIA. So, the double standard just reeks, as far as I'm concerned.
And if people are interested, you did a podcast with me where we both reviewed the Duty book, you with much greater familiarity with Bob Gates, but I enjoyed that conversation, and people might want to check that out. Just one more question on pre-publication review. David Petraeus, his book, of course, was carefully vetted, right?
Of course. Probably as carefully vetted as the classified notes he gave to his mistress that could have landed him in jail for several years. After all, there were names of clandestine operatives in those notebooks, and that put John Kiriakou in jail for a three-year sentence. I think it was cut short by a year or so. But again, good example of the double standard.
Yes, indeed. And Kiriakou's been a guest on this program many times, and his story is amazing. And also just his resilience. I mean, he is still, very much on fire. And I very much value his voice in the current context. And Mel, I really appreciated your book because it's partly a memoir, and I learned quite a bit about you. And we'll talk about some of your history during this conversation. It's also a fascinating whistleblower narrative and an annotated critique of the CIA's drift from its original mission to what you describe as politicization and militarization. But Mel, what I find most relevant about your book today is that it is a litany, and I just picked a number. It's 137 reasons not to trust the CIA, especially when they're lying about Russia. And I'm one of those people who doesn't buy the narrative that's been advanced by the intelligence community, embraced by 17 intelligence agencies, we were told by Hillary Clinton, and the Democrats continue to pump the idea that Russia hacked and that Russia manipulated our election. Now, I will certainly accept that as soon as evidence is presented and as soon as people come out of the shadows and the anonymous leakers identify themselves. But until that point, I'm going to remain skeptical. And your book gives me all those reasons not to trust the CIA, especially on Russia.
Well, I think the hysteria over Russia is something that has to be taken into account. We've had it in this country since 1917 when we refused to recognize the Soviet Union for 16 years. It took President Roosevelt to do that. And there's always been a tremendous exaggeration of the Soviet threat. And actually, the politicization that you talk about really started in a corporate way with the politicization of intelligence on the Soviet Union throughout the 1980s, and that's what led me to leave. It turned me into a contrarian and a dissident in the 1980s. It wasn't until Gates was nominated as a CIA director, so they sent back to the CIA the very person who was responsible for the politicization, and that turned me into a whistleblower.
Mm-hmm. And how do you react to this current narrative? Are you more persuaded than I am by the representations? And what did you think of the January 16th report that, the CIA said that they assessed with high confidence, but not offering a shred of public evidence, that Russia manipulated?
Well, here I guess we will have to part company. I don't think what Russia did had an impact on the election. Mm-hmm. I hope we're not as stupid. Certainly, the French were not fooled by the Russian attempts to influence the election in France.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the evidence is good and that the Russian cyber fingerprints are all over the hacking operation. How this material got to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks is another matter, but I do think that Assange and Putin shared an obsession, and that obsession was with Hillary Clinton. And Putin's feeling that Hillary Clinton manipulated the parliamentary elections in Russia in 2011, 2012, and that the State Department was involved in manipulating the Ukrainian situation has to be seen in the context of Putin's background in the KGB and his awareness of what the CIA did in Poland in the early 1980s in trying to influence the domestic situation and providing assistance covertly to Solidarność, to Solidarity, the labor organization. So Putin has his reasons for his attitudes toward Hillary Clinton, but I think what the Russians have been doing lately in throughout East and West Europe, as well as the United States, has been gathering intelligence on domestic politics. The question I have is, what has the CIA been doing in this period of time, and why haven't we done with Russia what we did with China after China broke into the OPM computer data bank and took hundreds of thousands of names? Beijing and Washington worked out a series of ground rules, which I think is needed with Russia. The cyber weapon is a very dangerous weapon. When the United States and Israel used it against Iran, that to me was an act of war. The United States and Israel broke into the Iranian nuclear program, compromised hundreds of centrifuges, set the program back for a very short period of time. The system eventually leaked out into the wider computer community, and it had to be stopped. But this obviously is a dangerous technology that we don't quite understand, and there are no rules of the road. We have rules for engagements at sea. We have rules for engagements in the air, but nothing for cyberspace, and I think this needs to be done. And I blame, to a certain degree, Obama's demonization of Putin in his second term, which made that dire relationship much more dire than it needed to be. I think we do have to get it back on track. I think we need to resume the dialogue. I'm not sure exactly what Trump's ambitions were toward Russia. What I find very confusing is that he really wanted to resume some kind of institutionalized dialogue or symmetry with Russia. Why did he appoint all these generals to security positions within the national security community who are very opposed to dealing with Russia and very opposed to arms control? So nothing adds up in this situation.
Well, I think we have a plenty of agreement here, Mel. The point where maybe we part ways is that, yes, there are Russian fingerprints, but do you really think that Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear and the reference in Cyrillic to the founder of the KGB is something that Russia would have left behind? Bill Binney, the former technical director at the NSA, is someone I've talked to three or four times over the course of this imbroglio, if you will. And he maintains, look, if there was a hack of the DNC computers, the NSA can trace it. They've got every node, every network connection wired, and they would be able to tell us that. And Obama could have declassified information to offer some level of evidence, and so could Trump have. And so we are left as a public, with these narratives, as I said, that are based on leaks and evidence that we're told exists but that we're not allowed to see. And it creates, to me, a real crisis in the credibility of the intelligence community.
Well, that's always a mistake when you allow that kind of impression to form. And Bill Binney is someone I genuinely respect. I've had him lecture to my classes at Johns Hopkins on several occasions. And probably there's no better authority on cybersecurity and cyber analysis than Binney. This is a very serious person, and I know he believes that it was a leak from inside the Democratic National Committee. But I've talked to people whose I also respect who are convinced that Russians' cyber fingerprints are all over this operation. And we're seeing it played out in Europe, too. You know, the United States isn't unique in this campaign at all. This is a general phenomenon that we're seeing used against Western democracy.
But this is also a case where, we know that IP addresses can be faked and misdirected. Putin was making that comment to Oliver Stone in the series of interviews that I watched last week. And that's not a secret or unknown to anybody who has cyber skills. Also,
that's true, but we've Putin got a... also said it could have been patriotic Russians who had nothing to do with the government. So that was a little too coy on his part.
Agreed.
What was he suggesting with with that remark. And clearly he's having a lot of fun with this. He's, right. he's just offered political asylum to James Comey, for crying out loud. So he's having a great party over this. And frankly, I don't blame him, because if you look at American national security policy right now on Russia or any other issue for that matter, it really doesn't make much sense.
And Mel Stuxnet, that you referenced, the computer hacking of Iran, I do agree was an act of war. And we have to assume that it's not the only successful cyber attack that has been mounted by the United States. There's a whole new cyber division of the NSA/Pentagon with several thousand people who we are told, I heard Mike Hayden say this, that about 80% of it is aggressive. It's offensive. And our media never acknowledges the deep investment that we have in offensive cyber warfare and the likelihood of blowback.
Yeah, this is being taken as just another phase in agitation and propaganda. You know, the kind of thing we did in the 1980s, accusing the Soviets of involvement in the papal plot, the attempt to assassinate the Pope in 1981, or talking about military exploits that the Soviets were not even involved with. But this isn't just another phase. This has very dangerous implications for international security, and I don't see any real attempt to sit down with the Russians and get into rules of the road in this area, as well as getting back to arms control and disarmament. Again, if Trump was really serious about improving relations with Russia, why is he so hostile to arms control and appoint people who are hostile to arms control? So something is missing from this picture.
Indeed. And the one other thing I'll add is that, those who have embraced this idea that Russia manipulated the American election, they didn't use the mechanisms available. The Democrats didn't challenge the certification of the election. They didn't use the Electoral College to try to prevent, the final stempel, if you will, on Trump's election. And they didn't use the final step, the certification in the United States Senate, in early January, even to raise issues about this. And likewise, we hear these warnings coming from Mark Warner and others in the intelligence committees that, Russia's going to do it again. Well, we're not lifting a finger to harden our election computer systems, to recognize the hackability by Americans or others of our election process. And so I find this idea that we're going to study it and, we're going to investigate it, but nobody is taking any steps except for more sanctions that, again, are based on inconclusive allegations.
No, I can understand your concern in that area, because, to me, Russia and the United States have a lot of common interests that are extremely important and overwhelm a lot of the differences. That is, they're similar concerns on arms control, on disarmament, on counterproliferation, on terrorism, on making sure Iran doesn't develop nuclear weapons, or trying to control the nuclear program in North Korea. These are all areas of tremendous agreement where I think we could achieve some progress. Mm-hmm. And the differences that we're talking about are something that I think can be discussed and could be negotiated and gotten out of the way in due course. But I don't see anyone taking this on. Right now, we don't have a Department of State. You have a Secretary of State who knows nothing about international security or international relations, and you don't have any of the top positions in the Department of State being staffed.
Yeah.
So diplomacy has come to a halt with this administration, and what I worry about is when Trump finds out, as he's learning day by day, that he'll probably be able to achieve nothing in domestic policy because he has no agenda and he doesn't have the discipline to create one, it's going to be very easy, as it has been for other presidents, to manipulate military forces. And this is a great concern to me, because that's where this militarization of policy, just in the last 24 hours, turning over Afghan policy toward the military, that's the last place you want to put policy toward Afghanistan, because we've been there in a failure, in an unwinnable situation, on a fool's errand for the last 16 years, in an area where we have no national security or strategic interests whatsoever. So how do you get this train back on the rails is what mystifies me at this point.
Indeed. Now, Mel, did you have a chance to watch any of the Oliver Stone interviews with Putin?
I didn't.
Okay. Well, I thought it was interesting, and I do recommend when you find the time that you take a look. Oliver Stone is not a great interviewer, but he did open up important topics and allow Putin to speak. And while we have to be skeptical, given his history and, just the obvious things, he does bullshit about the treatment of gays in Russia. He bullshits about their development of democracy. But he comes across as a man with a credible worldview who was able to outline without notes the way the U.S. has used NATO in recent years to try to encircle Russia. And to, in particular, pick off countries like Ukraine and move them into a European orbit. And so I felt that he offered viewpoints that are either only permitted in the U.S. media for the purpose of dismissing them or are just completely ignored. And particularly when it comes to the recent history of Ukraine, I think Americans really need to hear the full story, and our corporate media has not presented it.
Well, the point I've made in my writings in letters to the editor in places like the New York Times is that the United States is responsible for returning to Cold War policy, and they did it immediately in the Bill Clinton administration in the mid-1990s when we betrayed something we said to Russia to get them out of Germany, and that was the reference that James Baker, Secretary of State, made to Foreign Secretary Edward Shevardnadze in 1990 to get 380,000 Soviet troops out of East Germany. Baker and President George Bush said this to Gorbachev: if you get your troops out of East Germany, we will not leapfrog — that was the word Baker used — we will not leapfrog over East Germany to go into Eastern Europe. And of course, that's exactly what Clinton did, and that's exactly what Bush did. And it was interesting, when my wife and I were doing our book on Edward Shevardnadze, The Wars of Edward Shevardnadze, I interviewed both James Baker and Edward Shevardnadze, and both told the same story about the guarantees, not in writing, but verbally, that Baker made to the foreign secretary, to the foreign minister. So when you look at the expansion of NATO into the East European countries, the former members of the Warsaw Pact under Bill Clinton, and then the expansion of NATO into the former Soviet space itself by bringing in the three Baltic countries, and if it hadn't been for a very wise Angela Merkel calling Bush on several occasions, I think we would have tried to bring Georgia and Ukraine into NATO about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you add to that George Bush's abrogation of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which was the cornerstone of deterrence and a very important document to the Soviet Union, and then the deployment of a national missile defense in California and Alaska, a system that doesn't even work, but now the Pentagon poobahs are wanting an expansion of the system to the East Coast because there's so many resources involved in this, it would be a vast appropriation.
You mean you weren't impressed by that recent rigged test?
The rigged test where I thought the computer technology made sure there was a hit. I wrote a piece about that for Counterpunch.
Uh-huh.
About the reality of the North Korean program and the fantasy of United States missile defense. You know, we've been doing this since the Eisenhower administrations. Hundreds of billions of dollars have been wasted on a system that still can't tell the difference between a missile and a decoy. So we've made no progress whatsoever in 60 years, but that hasn't stopped us thus far.
Now, one more comment about Ukraine. Didn't the U.S. make a bilateral assurance to Ukraine that in exchange for giving up its nuclear weapons, that we would provide military defense if the sovereignty of Ukraine was threatened? And Obama just whiffed on that, didn't he?
Well, I think the three-way talks between Russia, Ukraine, and the United States, which I thought was a very bold effort by the Russians to secure a stable relationship with the United States, was to take all of Soviet strategic weaponry out of Ukraine, not only missiles, but their strategic bombers. And for that, there was language about protecting Ukrainian security if they were threatened by a third party, obviously meaning Russia.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we were prepared to really honor that commitment when Putin, say, took back Crimea. This was something that had been given to Ukraine in 1954 by Khrushchev in a apparently in a rather inebriated state. It shocked the Soviet community, including the Politburo, when this took place. And the question has been, you know, what are we willing to do for the East European states, including Baltic states that were formerly once part of the Soviet Union? These tripwire things we're doing by deploying modest numbers of aircraft and sending troops into Poland from time to time, I think these are meaningly gestures and just continue the situation. You know, Russia looks at Crimea the way we look at New Jersey. You know, we may be happy about everything that happens in New Jersey, but it's part of the United States. And Russia has certainly taken on a financial responsibility in taking Crimea back, but most Russians look at Crimea as part of the Russian state,
mm-hmm.
part of the Russian patrimony. And if we think this is going to be a precondition that the Russians must reverse themselves on Crimea, this is never going to happen.
It's a
very popular move on Putin's part. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think it's going to be reversed no matter what we do.
I agree. I certainly agree. Mel Goodman is my guest. His new book, Whistleblower at the CIA, and we'll get to his whistleblower experience here in a couple of minutes. Let's go back about 50 years, because when you first arrived at the CIA, this is during the LBJ administration, you were assigned and part of the team that was dealing with what became the Six-Day War. And we just observed the 50th anniversary of that, and I read your piece at Counterpunch about that whole experience and a reference to the USS Liberty. But take a moment here to share with our listeners that episode and how you had to fight, and there was politicization of intelligence in that particular drama.
Well, there was an attempt to politicize intelligence, but in the case of the Six-Day War, I must say we got backing from a very interesting CIA director, Richard Helms, who was probably one of the craftiest directors who ever led the CIA, and he stood by our analysis. The simple fact is that we formed a crisis management group in the weeks before the Six-Day War because tensions were mounting in the Middle East. Nasser was making a serious number of threats that we didn't think he could back up or even sustain in any way. And we did anticipate there was going to be a war. In fact, we provided intelligence to the White House that they did not accept that it would be a very short war. No one was as confident as we were that this was a war that wouldn't even last 2 weeks. And it turns out it wasn't even a week. But we knew enough on June the 5th to tell us that the Israelis lied to us when they said the Egyptians and Jordanians had attacked first. There was no Egyptian war plan. There was no movement of air assets. Their airplanes were parked on their airfields wingtip to wingtip, which is why Israel was able to destroy a couple hundred of them in the first 24 hours. Half of the Egyptian army was in Yemen fighting in that civil war in the 1960s. Nasser was making these threats that he couldn't back up, and I think Israel made the decision that we called it a preemption, but classically it wasn't even a preemptive attack because Egypt had no plan to attack first. It was a preventive attack. But when we sent this report over to the National Security Council on June the 5th, it came back almost immediately with some nasty notes from Walt Rostow, the National Security Advisor, saying, this was bullshit. He had guarantees from the Israeli ambassador that they would never attack first. We had to take this to the CIA director, Richard Helms, who backed us up. Said, you know, we're going to have to let Rostow down, but let him down easily. So make some editorial changes, whatever you need to do, but return the peace. And we did. And in the wake of that, Rostow named a study group led by Clark Clifford, who was head of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, and such Arabists from the State Department as Harold Saunders, and they backed up our interpretation of the intelligence. USS Liberty was a similar kind of situation, but a different outcome because of the politics of the Johnson administration at that time. And that was, we knew that this wasn't an accident. I think I wrote in the book, if it was an accident, it was the best planned accident I've ever witnessed.
Mm-hmm.
The Israelis conducted reconnaissance of the ship over a two-hour period. This is a ship that, in terms of its shape and configuration, looked like no other ship in any navy, particularly any Arab navy. It was flying a huge American flag. What I couldn't understand is why it was out in these dangerous waters at a time of warfare without any air cover. I've always been suspicious about that. The Israelis even warned the United States to get that ship out of there. So they knew exactly what they were doing, and they ended up killing about 34 sailors and injuring about 171, and even had boats in the water firing on rescue efforts. And one of the sad things about the whole episode on the 8th of June was that the first ship to come to the aid of the USS Liberty was a Soviet ship, and the captain of the USS Liberty waved the Soviet ship off. I don't know if he was protecting the sensitivity of the technology. I think it was more likely embarrassment that a Soviet Union was coming to provide support. But once again, the Israelis lied to us about the start of the war on the 5th, and they lied to us about the Liberty on the 8th. And the sensitive report that was done by the National Security Agency over the whole Liberty incident, I never got to see, and I don't know if anyone's gotten to read it. It's still classified. I mean, here it is 50 years later, and it hasn't been released. Now, what possible sources and methods could be compromised 50 years after the fact? So, again, it's the sensitivity of the politics and the sensitivity of the politics that led Lyndon Johnson not to make the issue out of this that I think we should have. This was an outrageous attack on Israel's part.
Now, one of the things I learned about Mel Goodman in reading your new book is that you accepted a job offer at the CIA despite the fact that you were opposed to the Vietnam War and the CIA was neck deep in the management of Operation Phoenix and many of the other covert activities that were a part of that. So describe a little bit about your early years and how you fit in or how you didn't.
Yeah, well, this is kind of interesting in a way. I was very active in the anti-war movement at Indiana University. There was an active teach-in movement there because a State Department officer had recently arrived on the campus, and I learned even more from him about what a fool's errand Vietnam was all about, and he was instrumental in organizing graduate students in the teach-in movement. And when I went to the CIA, he was so angry that he got off my dissertation committee, and I lost a lot of my liberal friends. So it was probably a puzzling thing to do, but when I got to the CIA, I joined, remember, the Director of Intelligence, not the Director of Operations. And if you look at the annexes to the Pentagon Papers that Daniel Ellsberg is responsible for, the intelligence on Vietnam from the CIA was spot on. Clearly, the CIA was telling the Johnson administration and the Nixon administration that the tactics weren't working, that this was going to ultimately be a political success for North Vietnam, that Kennedy's decision to allow the overthrow of the Diem regime meant that we never had an ally to work with in South Vietnam. So the debates about Vietnam that I took part in at the CIA around the table at the Office of National Estimates were far more intense and far more vigorous and controversial and filled with factual material than I ever engaged in at Indiana University or read in the press. Remember, when journalists first went over to Vietnam, they supported the war effort. Mm-hmm. They bought the Pentagon line, hook, line, and sinker. So the people that we think of who did such a great job, like, David Halberstam and Neil Sheehan and Ward Just, they didn't develop those positions right away. They were over in Vietnam for over a year before they understood the lies they were being fed by the military. So the military clearly fooled itself. It's kind of interesting to me that National Security Advisor General McMaster gets so much credit for the book he did, Dereliction of Duty, and he claims the dereliction was the failure of the generals to tell truth to power. That wasn't the failure. The real failure of the generals was they didn't look for the truth in Vietnam. They really had nothing to say to President Johnson or President Nixon because they didn't bother to read some of the good analysis that was out there by people like Lou Sarris at the State Department or Sam Adams at the CIA that showed this was an unwinnable fool's errand, and it was going to be a matter of time before we were going to have to leave with our tails between our legs.
And as we move into the Nixon era, with Kissinger playing the dual roles of Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, give us your view of that period between 68 when Nixon was elected. And then in 72, when he promised that peace was at hand, and the war continued for another, what, 3.5 years. How did that feel when you had access to this CIA intelligence that you describe as pretty accurate, and you saw the dissembling and the manipulation of that intelligence by the Nixon administration?
Yeah, I have sort of a dichotomous point of view about the situation, because whereas I was extremely critical of Henry Kissinger's and lies about Vietnam and Nixon's lies about Vietnam, at the same time, strategically, they were trying to pull off something that was very important to not only American national security, but international security, and that was moving closer toward both the Soviet Union and China to create the strategic triangle that would find the United States having better relations with both Beijing and Moscow than Beijing and Moscow had with each other. And that led to the SALT Treaty, the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty of 1972, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty of 1972, the Treaty of Berlin in 1971, eventual diplomatic relations with China under the Carter administration in 1978, 1979. So in terms of Kissinger's strategic impact on American foreign policy, I think it was an extremely significant period and probably the last strategic thrust in American diplomacy or American foreign policy. Nothing since then has been comparable, and no president has been able to really have an important impact or influence over foreign policy since Nixon and Kissinger. Clearly on Vietnam, they contributed to the horror. You know, how many more thousands of Americans died in Vietnam after Nixon took over the presidency and knew that there was no success in this policy whatsoever. But this line we keep hearing of not wanting to be the first president to lose a war rang very hollow to me, given what was happening and given the tragedy that Vietnam was, that we paid for in so many political, economic, and social ways for such a long period of time.
Now, Mel, as the truth about Watergate spilled out over time, we saw that some of the Nixon White House plumbers were former CIA people. And then we saw that Nixon tried to use the CIA to tell the FBI to back off from the Watergate investigation. That's a little deja vu all over again these days, isn't it?
It certainly is. And again, remember, the CIA had a deputy who was willing to go along with it. The deputy to Richard Helms was an Army general by the name of Vernon Walters.
Mm-hmm.
And in his first conversations at the White House, he said yes, he would go back and tell Richard Helms what was needed to be done to tell the FBI to call off the dogs. And Richard Helms would have none of it, and that's why Richard Helms was removed as CIA director and sent to Iran as an American ambassador to Tehran. So Helms, who's always been a very interesting figure to me, in fact, the best biography I've ever read about any CIA director is the Thomas Powers biography of Helms, the man who kept the secrets. And anyone who's really interested in sort of the political environment that the CIA is in and how the CIA has to operate within the Washington political community and how a CIA director has to work within the political situation really should take a look at that book. It's still the best thing out there as far as I'm concerned.
So after he was cashiered, a guy named William Colby was put in place, and he also, you know, ran afoul of the politics of the White House. But I want to move forward to Stansfield Turner, who was put into the CIA by Jimmy Carter in an effort to clean it up after the Church and Pike commissions had exposed, you know, much of the perfidy and also failures of the CIA. And Turner was the guy who ended up presiding over the missed intelligence about the Iranian Revolution and the fall of the Shah.
Yeah, let me say something about both of these men, because I got to know them rather well. And when I was at the National War College, I brought both Colby and Turner over to lecture to the classes there. Turner, of course, had a lot of credibility with the students as a former admiral in the Navy. I was always convinced, in the case of Colby, who was devout Catholic, a practicing Catholic, that he had tremendous guilt about his directorship of the Phoenix program, which conducted a serious assassination policy. And I think some innocent lives were lost. And I think there was tremendous guilt on his part for his role in that. So when the investigation started at the CIA, and I give Seymour Hersh from the New York Times credit for breaking that story, Kobe moved very quickly to cooperate with the investigation, so quickly that Henry Kissinger was furious. Remember that Helms was forced out because he wouldn't cooperate, and Kobe was put in because they thought he was a very weak figure who could be controlled. And it turns out he couldn't be controlled. Kobe did a lot in the world of intelligence analysis, which was the original mission of the CIA and what Harry Truman wanted when he created the CIA in 1947. And again, Stansfield Turner, when he arrived, and remember, this is someone who had never served a tour of duty in Washington, was very naive about Washington politics, was a stranger to the hardball politics that are played in Washington, was severely outmaneuvered by the late Zbigniew Brzezinski, who didn't like Turner's access to President Carter. So when the intelligence failure over Iran took place, and I blame the senior analysts who covered Iran, because a lot of good clues were missed. And let me digress just for a second. When you look at intelligence failures of the CIA, I would argue that in every case, the collection was good enough to prevent the failure. Every intelligence failure I'm aware of was due to faulty analysis, a lack of rigor, a lack of imagination, a lack of any ability to see change in a situation that analysts had become very comfortable with. But that the collection was there, and that was true for 9/11, and it was true for the October War, and it was true for so many intelligence failures, including the Arab Spring in 2011. So Turner took the hit for Iran. Brzezinski wrote a letter that Carter signed that went to Turner that maligned the analysts. Turner was so generous and kind that he put that letter in his desk drawer and made sure the analysts never saw it. I found out about it years later. Brzezinski, who wasn't kind, leaked the letter to the press to embarrass Turner and to embarrass the CIA. And granted, it wasn't a great moment in intelligence analysis for the CIA, because clearly they were wrong. I learned a lot about how politics is played in Washington to watch the way Brzezinski manipulated and moved against Turner. And he actually did the same thing against Cyrus Vance, the Secretary of State, and his special advisor on the Soviet Union, Marshall Shulman. In fact, a lot of the rivalry to me was a continuation of a rivalry that was started when these two men were at Columbia University. And remember, Brzezinski, who died a dove, lived as a hawk for many, many years.
Oh, Shulman, indeed.
And had a much more realistic view of the Soviet Union, and I thought was far more sophisticated than Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Well, I don't have your depth of knowledge or experience, but my impression of Brzezinski is totally negative. He was the architect of our covert role in Afghanistan, which we are still dealing with.
We're still paying for that one.
Yes, we are.
He took the CIA into Afghanistan before the Soviets got there, and I don't think that's widely known.
Yeah. Also, bringing the Shah to the United States and also taking Marcos in, those were both gross miscalculations and deep violations of the foreign policy that was enunciated by President Carter, which, for the first time linked to human rights, or at least to some extent. And I thought that Brzezinski undermined him in many significant ways.
Well, he also undermined what I talked about earlier, the strategic triangle that I give Kissinger credit for. He totally mishandled that and didn't know how to continue it because, again, given his East European background, he was so anti-Soviet. He didn't see the genius in trying to manipulate Beijing and Moscow against each other, so he turned so anti-Soviet, it gave China negotiating room against us. So he blew both sides of the triangle, and I don't think Carter, who was quite overwhelmed by Brzezinski's intellect. I'll never forget when Carter was interviewing people for the cabinet, and they flew down the planes, and on one particular day, he saw James Schlesinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski, and he went to the press cameras and journalists and said, I've just met two of the brightest men I've ever met in my life. And I thought, oh, my God, we're in for an interesting ride now. Schlesinger came to the CIA in 1973. Actually, he replaced Helms for a short period of time before Colby came in.
Yeah.
And he brought all the Soviet analysts in and said, you people are going to stop fucking Richard Nixon. That's when I realized this is going to be a whole new world.
Mm-hmm. And before we delve into the Casey administration at the CIA, I didn't notice any reference to his role in the October surprise, the deal with Iran to hold the hostages until after the election. And I think that was a really significant, a pivotal event. And I will never forget the watching Reagan's inauguration as he's giving the oath, and the split screen shows that plane with the hostages taking off from Tehran. Do you have any criticism of the October surprise theory, or did you just decide not to?
I decided not to deal with it because I didn't know anything on my own about it.
Mm-hmm.
All I could do was rely on secondary sources.
I see.
And even though it seemed very plausible, and I have no respect for Bill Casey whatsoever, I never did. And I think I have the anecdote in the book about when I was at the State Department in 73, 74, when Kissinger arrived as Secretary of State, and he was being taken around by a young Foreign Service officer, and he passed a nameplate on the wall, William Casey, Under Secretary of State for Economic Affairs. And Kissinger turned to this hapless Foreign Service officer and said, what the hell's he doing here? How did he get in the building? And this kid, all he could do was say, I don't know, sir. He says, well, get him out of here.
And the other thing you added was that Kissinger said, he's senile.
He's senile. And from my dealings with Casey, yes, he was senile. He was impossible. Well, on the one hand, you couldn't understand what he was saying anyway. His language was so garbled, and his syntax was so garbled. And he had just really one notion, and that was covert action everywhere. He was going to take it on himself to bring down the Soviet Union. And, of course, he had a colleague over at the State Department, Alexander Haig, who was totally paranoid about the Soviets because he thought they tried to assassinate him when he was commanding NATO in 1980. So between Haig and Casey and Weinberger, Richard Pipes over at the White House, Ronald Reagan really assembled a group of neocons of their day who did a lot of damage to American foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. And so in that era, this is where your friend from graduate school in Bloomington, Bob Gates, shows up at the CIA, and you took him to lunch at the cafeteria on his first day. Things changed after a while.
Well, one thing that didn't change was the assessment I made when I came back and I said to my colleagues that I'd just taken Bob to lunch, and I warned them that I said, one day we're going to be working for him. He was the most ambitious, hardworking person I'd ever met in my life at that point. And I was only wrong to the extent that it happened much sooner than I thought it possibly could have happened, because 15 years later, he was the deputy director for intelligence. He was the most ambitious person, and nothing was going to get in Bob's way, and he made sure of that. So whatever Casey wanted, I mean, this was a clear case of Geppetto and Pinocchio. And Geppetto pulled all of the strings, and it was Pinocchio's job to carry out what Casey wanted. And he was the filter for this politicization.
And this led to conflicts where you had a few arguments with him about specific intelligence findings. And this is where it really is where you became informed, and this is what led to your whistleblowing when you publicly opposed his confirmation as CIA director in 1991. Now, we'll get to that part, but I wanted to lay that out because talk a little bit about the issues where you found that Gates and Casey were trying to put their thumb into the intelligence reports to spin up a much more dire threat from the Soviet Union. And you make the point, pardon me, as a bottom line assessment, that that Reagan and the buildup in our defense and all the other things that we claim brought down the Soviet Union really were not significant factors.
Yeah, I don't think that had anything to do with the decline of the Soviet Union. I've always thought the Soviet Union was a house of cards, and it fell like a house of cards. Its economy wasn't relevant to the international economy. Its military was falling way behind. Afghanistan wasn't that costly, but it was a disaster for Soviet interests. They were irrelevant. And that's something Gorbachev and Shevardnadze, who knew each other very well because they used to meet at party meetings, and they talked about if we ever got to Moscow, you know, these are the things we're going to address. But, you know, the problem was, and Shevardnadze told us that in the interview, that when they got to Moscow, things were much worse than they realized. They got there in 1985, 1986. So Reagan's Star Wars and Reagan's Axis or Evil Empire and all of the language he used and all of the rhetoric really had nothing to do with bringing down the Soviet Union. But the right wing...
But wait a minute, Mel.
There's not much you can do about that.
Excuse me for interrupting, Mel, but I saw the photo op at the Berlin Wall.
Exactly. Tear down this wall.
The other thing that is I think important is that you left the CIA about 1986, and that's when you went to the National War College. And on an annual basis, you would take some of your students, military officers, on foreign junkets. And some of those were to the Soviet Union. Mostly, you led those particular groups. And this gave you some firsthand knowledge and interaction with key people in the Soviet Union that really helped cement your view that Casey and Gates had fudged the record. They had rigged the intelligence.
Well, actually, my first trips to the Soviet Union were in the mid-1970s. 76, I think, was my first trip. And I realized then that the economy of the Soviet Union was comparable to the economy of Greece, where I served as a soldier in mid-1950s. I mean, when you left Moscow or Leningrad, you were into a very backward third world country. So you realize how much the Russians had paid for the military force they did develop. But if you look at just the military area, all of the great breakthroughs in military technology, which I think the Carter administration was responsible for but never got credit for it because they had a very smart Secretary of Defense, Harold Brown, who was a scientist in his own right, had really stolen a march on the Soviet Union. So with the deployment of Pershing 2 and cruise missiles in Europe, I think the Russians knew to a certain extent that they had to conduct international diplomacy differently, which is what Gorbachev and Shevardnadze were trying to do. But the trip to the Soviet Union, I'll never forget, was the last Soviet trip was 1991, because we arrived at JFK to get a plane to go to Washington. We had time to buy a copy of the New York Times, which you couldn't get in the Soviet Union in 1991. And there on the front page was George H.W. Bush nominates Bob Gates to be CIA director. And that's what switched me from the column of dissident contrarian to whistleblower, because I decided, you know, I had a story to tell the Intelligence Committee if they were willing to listen. Fortunately, they had a director on the Democratic side who eventually became the CIA director, George Tenet, who had a staff member who was interested in politicization, and they listened to what I had to say.
Well, and Mel, I've had the opportunity to talk to whistleblowers from CIA, DEA, FBI, Secret Service, the TSA, did I mention DEA? I can't remember. Anyway, to a person, they all say, I wear this label with great discomfort. I never sought to be a whistleblower. I never thought that term would be linked to my name.
That would certainly be my impression. You don't join the government to be a whistleblower. It's not a cognitive decision that you make to be a whistleblower. You don't get introspective and then decide to become a whistleblower. I think in my case and everything I've read about, and particularly Sally Yates's testimony on May the 8th, which was really riveting to me, suggested that you join the government to do good, and the highest good you can do is to report political misconduct. And when a whistleblower sees something that just crosses the line, something just clicks on that the right thing to do is to report this malfeasance. Very few people are willing to do it. I think there's a certain personality type. You know, there's probably an authoritarian personality type, so there must be an anti-authoritarian personality type. I've always considered myself anti-authoritarian. So something, when I saw that in the New York Times, a paper I've read every day of my life for the last 60 years or so, something just clicked on that something needed to be done.
And I found it interesting. I did not know that your wife, Lynn Ekdahl, had served at the agency for decades, and her role in your whistleblowing experience. And I want to hasten to add that you weren't married at the time, but perhaps the whistleblowing experience opened your hearts. I don't know.
I think it had a lot to do with it. It
did
certainly
it?
Was it was a bonding mission. I testified. She filed a sworn affidavit. She went on to do tremendously good work in the Office of Inspector General before Obama really wrecked the office, and did excellent studies on torture and abuse and extraordinary renditions, the missionary plane that was shot down over Peru, in which every aspect of tradecraft was dishonored and the CIA tried to cover up what had happened. You know, excellent work that the CIA no longer does because Obama has weakened the Inspector General offices so greatly that we've lost that tool of internal oversight that's so important.
Well, and I don't diminish Obama's responsibility, but I also would insert Leon Panetta here, because I've known Panetta since he was a member of Congress from Monterey, and then he chaired the Budget Committee in the House, and then he went into the Clinton White House. Then he retired, and he resurfaced as Obama's first CIA director. And I have twin complaints. One is that, you know, he basically was a facilitator and maintained continuity. You know, Obama promised us change, but what we got was extreme continuity on many bad policies. And my feeling is that Panetta has never been held to account for the drone program that he managed from the CIA, which advances your argument about the excessive militarization of your agency. And I believe that because he's an affable guy and is friendly with reporters, that he really skated for, you know, many things that he was responsible for, both as CIA director and Pentagon boss.
Well, I totally agree with you, and I've written about Panetta, and my argument about Panetta is that he arrived at the CIA, and within 24 hours, he was totally captured by the operational culture and the operational ethic or lack of ethics of the operational culture, and that's when the real damage to the Office of the Inspector General was done. But it was something that Obama did support, because for his 8 years in office, for over four of those years, there was no Inspector General at the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever one left, like when my good friend John Helgerson, who was the last good Inspector General, he put off retirement until after the Obama election, thinking that given all the damage Bush was trying to do to the Inspector General, that Obama would reverse all that. Well, not only did he not reverse it, one, he named Leon Panetta, who was a disaster. The operational nickname for him behind his back was Uncle Leon, because they just couldn't take the man seriously. He was affable. He was pleasant. He's a storyteller. And my guess is, if when I look at his record in terms of on paper, I'm sure he did good work at some point in his career. But these last 10 years or so, and his continued non-statements he makes on CNN on a regular basis, it reminds me of Chauncey Gardner from the movie Being There, the last film Peter Sellers ever made. The guy really has nothing to say. Yet here he was, CIA director and Secretary of Defense. It's unbelievable that you could have such a lightweight in such important positions for such a long period of time.
What is your view as to why Obama and, in this case, Panetta, went to bat to look forward and not backward and never touch the issues of CIA torture? I really respect the ink that you've devoted in your book to Dianne Feinstein's effort to compile and then publish the CIA torture review. Clearly you're offended by the wrongdoing that your agency was responsible for. But why did Obama and Panetta make the calculated decision that we are going to obstruct justice here? We are not going to hold anyone accountable.
Well, I was a strong supporter of Obama in 2008, but when I wrote and when I lectured, I said, but remember one thing. He really has no experience whatsoever in national security. So don't expect too much in foreign policy or diplomacy or national security, but he hasn't been tested. And the day I heard he was going to retain Bob Gates as Secretary of Defense convinced me that he was going to be totally intimidated by the military intelligence complex, the national security state that's grown up in this country, sadly to say, since 9/11. Keeping Gates was a signal to the Pentagon, like, hey, I'm not going to make any waves. You can continue to do what you're doing. You'll even get more to spend than you had under George Bush, which clearly happened. And when he sent Leon Panetta, a tired, very tired bureaucrat, out to the CIA, it was one more sign. And then he put military people in key positions. He made a Marine general. National Security Advisor General Jones was a disaster and had to get out in 18 months or so.
Right.
And all of his appointments, I think, actually Hillary Clinton, the State Department, she didn't have the credentials to be a Secretary of State, and actually she sort of messed up her copybook in her first week with her email server.
Yes, she did.
So Obama, I think his intimidation, he was rolled by the military on the so-called surge in Afghanistan. I think over a period of time, he realized some of this and moved against continued expansion of the military, but he never, never moved against the CIA. And when he made John Brennan the CIA director in the second term, that was a complete sellout because he wanted to make John Brennan the CIA director in 2009, and a lot of us started to write. I was very active, reminding people about Brennan's role in the torture and abuse campaign that the CIA started under George Tenet when he was on the executive secretariat. And to me, of all the appalling aspects of the torture and abuse program, which is totally unconscionable, the fact that all of these men could sit around a table on the seventh floor of the CIA building without one person saying, you know, this is probably not something we should be doing.
Yeah.
And even if we learn something, and what Dianne Feinstein's report shows, we learn nothing from torture and abuse, which came as no surprise to people who were professionals in this regard, and particularly FBI agents who got the hell out of the way when they saw what the CIA was doing in these Afghan and Iraqi facilities, let alone the secret prisons in places like Poland and Romania and Thailand. So this was a despicable series of events, and Obama kept this point he raised about this is not who we are. Well, what did Obama really do about showing what it was we really were? Because he asked, as you say, no accountability, no responsibility. Jose Rodriguez gave the order to destroy the torture tapes. Nothing happened to him. And the person who sent the cable to destroy the tapes at the command of Rodriguez, who attacked my wife and attacked me in his book, the person who sent that cable is now the deputy director of the CIA. That's who Director Pompeo named as a director. That's a real in-your-face gesture to say that there was nothing wrong with torture and abuse. We did it, and we may have to do it again because we have people in the administration, including the president himself, who have never seriously criticized the policy of torture and abuse, and now you have a Republican chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee who's recalled all of the copies of the torture and abuse report,
right,
including not only the CIA copy, but the copy of the Inspector General of the CIA. So that report will never be seen, and I blame Obama for not releasing the report, which he could have done. Instead, he really chickened out. He sent a copy over to the National Archives, and I guess the Federal Registry, and maybe in 15 years someone can appeal for it. But you know damn well when someone files a Freedom of Information Act, you know, if it took 11 months for my book to get out, it'll take 11 years for them to deal with the Freedom of Information Act on the torture and abuse report.
Well, and the Obama White House actively colluded with John Brennan to first delay and then to try to prevent the release of anything more than the redacted executive summary. And
yeah, but O'Brennan did even worse. I mean, he sanctioned and actually called for a break-in of the computers of the Senate Democratic staff. And then when he was accused of this by Dianne Feinstein, he went public. I remember he was giving a talk, I think, at the Brookings Institution or the Carnegie Endowment, and said, it would be, and this is an exact quote, it would be beyond the scope of reason to think that the CIA would do anything like that. Well, really, that's exactly what they did. Again, no consequences, no accountability, no responsibility.
Right.
Welcome to Washington.
Mel, in the book, you note several times that 9/11 really gave license to many of the abuses and changes that occurred. You also take some swipes at Phil Zelikow, who managed the 9/11 Commission and essentially was the editor of the report that was published. Now, I want to be very clear here because I'm not an Alex Jones-type truther. Okay, I don't advance some alternate theory that it was an inside job or that I know more than is available publicly. But I watched in Washington. I spent a week at my own expense covering the public hearings of the 9/11 Commission. They were a joke. And so much of the physical evidence contradicts theories that are advanced as part of the official narrative. So in simple terms, do you have any questions about the official 9/11 story, or do you embrace the work of the 9/11 Commission?
Well, I can't embrace the Commission because I have no respect for Philip Zelikow whatsoever. He's one of these figures who stays around in the government, in the academic community. He goes from Harvard to the government, to the University of Virginia, to back to the government. And he gets involved in reports that are ultimately designed to make the government look good or make sure they don't look as bad as they should look if you had a rigorous investigation. And I know, and I'm strongly convinced that the role of the CIA wasn't properly examined by the commission. There were people from the CIA put on the commission as staffers who I think were involved in cover-up. I don't believe some of the conspiratorial notions about who was responsible for 9/11, but that was a terrible, terrible intelligence failure.
And let me interrupt. Would you agree that by taking the most extremes, like Alex Jones, and calling them tinfoil hat conspiracy theorists, they effectively marginalize anybody who asks legitimate questions, like Senator Bob Graham, who chaired the Intelligence Committee, ran the first investigation before the Kane-Hamilton Commission was established, and he kept fighting for the release of the 28 pages relative to the Saudis. Now, as after they were finally released, they're not a conclusive document, but the failure to follow up on those is a clear indication to me of intentional cover-up.
Well, yeah, I agree, and I would add to that, it's not only compromising the people who ask legitimate questions, it gives credibility to the people who ask illegitimate questions. It allows someone like an Alex Jones to step forward, just as the terrible job that was done on the Kennedy assassination, which the CIA didn't completely cooperate with. There are still documents we haven't seen that go back to the Kennedy assassination, which allowed conspiracy theory to emerge in terms of who was actually involved and how did this assassination take place. But I'm not convinced we get to learn, and I say this because of what's happening today with all of these investigations, do we really learn everything we need to know? Did we learn everything we needed to know about Iran-Contra despite a very serious effort that was made to understand Iran-Contra, and it took 6 or 7 years? And now we have, and I have great respect from McCullough and the FBI, the former FBI director who's now going to lead this investigation. Are we ever going to learn everything that we need to know? I'm always very doubtful about this. Mm-hmm. I think there's always some tendency in some of these commissions, and this was true for 9/11, of Democrats blocking criticism of their people and Republicans blocking criticism of their principles. And so there's a certain consensus that emerges that doesn't allow the rough edges, sort of the bark on the tree that we need to see to show where are the rough spots in this investigation that show that maybe we don't have all of the answers. You know, what are the unknowns? I hate to quote Donald Rumsfeld in this, but...
Oh, don't.
I guess I shouldn't, but the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns. Do we learn all of these things?
No, we don't.
So I'm always leery.
So finally, Mel, I want to ask a pointed question here. Do you feel that in your book, particularly when you talk about politicization and about the militarization, do you think that you are too polite, particularly on politicization, because that word doesn't have quite the sense of indictment? But, you know, often we saw intentional manipulation of intelligence with catastrophic results. And, you know, the intelligence about Iraq is just one example. But if anything, I feel that in some cases you've understated it.
I don't think so, because remember my earlier work, Failure of Intelligence, 2008, I thought was a pretty devastating critique. I had one chapter on White House manipulation of the intelligence,
right,
and I had another chapter on CIA manipulation of intelligence, and I had some very critical comments of what the Pentagon did that was even worse than what the CIA did. And with this book, remember, I was trying to cover my years when I was with CIA, and of course by 2002 to 2003, I was long gone. So that really wasn't part of my charge as I saw it. So I think the case for politicization is there, and it's pretty strong in that chapter about why I left, because it deals mainly with the Soviet problem, where Casey and Gates were responsible for the deceit and the disinformation.
Well, let me clarify. I read Failure of Intelligence. We did an interview, and I agree that you were very strong there. And I also believe in your new book, you reveal quite a bit and emphasize what went on. I would use a stronger word than politicization in many of these cases, because I think it's just a little bit too flat. So my argument is not about the thrust of what you wrote. It's about your choice of word there.
Yeah, I guess here I'll tell you what the problem is. This is a word that I think I use in the hearings that had never been used in the world of intelligence before. So I'm very proud of that word. I'm proud of putting that word in the lexicon. And frankly, you're one of the few people who can pronounce it. So usually I get interviewed or talk to people who can't say politicization. Now you can, so that gives you a certain amount of credibility with me. But I'm going to keep using that word. I'm very fond of it.
Well, that's your story, and you're welcome to stick to it, okay?
Right. I'm going to stand by what I meant to say.
Melvin A. Goodman, it's been a pleasure to talk to you once again, and I highly recommend your book, Whistleblower at the CIA. And as I said at the outset, you offer a lot of important information for, I think, contemporary analysis of the CIA, and I welcome its addition to my library.
Well, thank you, and this, last week I started my next book, so I hope in 2 years we can do this again.
Well, subject to pre-approval by your friends
right,
at Langley.
We'll just add 11 months on to whatever my scheduled publication date is.
Melvin A. Goodman, thanks again.
Thank you, Peter. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to my in-depth interview with Mel Goodman. I welcome your feedback. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.